You are listening to Money on the Left, the official podcast of the Modern Money Network Humanities Division, or MMNHD. Julie Mell, Associate Professor of History at North Carolina State University and author of the book, The Myth of the Medieval Jewish Moneylender, is this week's guest. At NC State, Mell teaches courses in medieval history, Jewish history, and economic thought. She also recently served as a fellow at the Center for the History of Political Economy and as a visiting scholar at the Center for Hebrew and Judaic Studies at the University of Oxford. In The Myth of the Medieval Jewish Moneylender, Mell marshals previously untapped primary sources to upend the common historical narrative regarding the role of Jewish moneylenders in the development of the modern economy. On Mell's reading, the prevailing understanding of the medieval Jewish moneylender, common to both anti-Semitic and philo-Semitic discourses in the 19th and 20th centuries, has no more basis in history than does the prevailing myth of barter. In this episode, Scott and Max speak with Mell about these and other connections that may be drawn between her own and neo-chartalism's critical projects. Thank you for listening, and thanks also to Alex Williams for producing the episode.
Julie Mell, welcome to Money on the Left.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
So I was wondering if we could start by having you tell us a little bit about your scholarly background and your intellectual training and what sort of brought you to your current book project.
Sure. I was a major in the history of religions, and I started out interested in East Asian studies. And I gravitated back to Abrahamic religions by the end of college, and I was really struck, I think, with two fields that I was thinking about going on to graduate school in. One was rabbinic Judaism, and the other was medieval history. As things turned out, I did enter a master's program in medieval history, working with a women's historian, a very well-recognized women's historian at the time. But I had meanwhile been not only working on my Latin to enter medieval studies program, but I had been learning modern Hebrew. And I'd just come back from a summer in an Olpan in Tel Aviv. And so I asked her, can I continue with modern Hebrew? Fortuitously, there had just been hired in the research area where I was a graduate student at other universities, but ones that collaborated with ours, a professor of Hebrew literature and a chaired professor in Jewish history who happened to be a medievalist. So through the kind of confluence of those things, I ended up starting out working on the Jewish community in medieval England. My professor, who was a women's historian at the time, it was at a point where women's history was transitioning into gender studies. There was a lot of discussion and debate around the issues of difference and recognizing differences among women. And so she asked me to work on Jews as a way of bringing the Jews as a major minority group in medieval Europe as a way of bringing in difference into conversations about gender and women's history. So actually the first paper I wrote in graduate school was on medieval Jewish women moneylenders. But even then, I had a sense when I finished that first research paper that there was something profoundly wrong about it, or there was something off, one could say. Women's history at the time, well, and still today, very often has a heroic mode to it, right? So you're recovering voices, you're recovering women's economic activities where we've assumed there weren't any. And so the female moneylenders became the heroes, the heroines, right, of this piece of research. Hmm. And yet at the same time, I was aware in the background of all the stereotypes about Jews and moneylending. And so it sat very uneasily with me. And I actually abandoned that work and moved in very different areas, ended up moving after the master's to religious studies to do a lot more training with the rabbinic scholar, who was the one who ultimately oversaw my dissertation. And my plan when I started out with the dissertation that would eventually become the book was that I would work on a type of Hebrew text known in English as responsa, in Hebrew as shelot utshuvot, questions and answers. And these are actually legal texts that are sent from one rabbi or one rabbinic court to another, which they recognize as superior, asking for advice in a particular case, or sometimes asking theoretical questions, which they'll frame as if it were a case. And we have many, many of these from medieval Europe. They have not been used very much at all for historical work. So I wanted to work on a gender issue in relation to economics through this kind of source. So I actually had a dissertation project that was, well, it was inspired, I would say, by Marxist feminist work that was looking at household as a form of work. And this was at a point in the 90s when major turn to notions of identity, of performativity were really forefront. And I felt that there was something been lost in terms of the materialist base and a kind of a Marxist or socialist critique. So what I wanted to do was to examine this issue of separation between market and household, and I was going to do it in this type of source known as responsa, using the Jewish community as an example for all of Europe. And the more that I got into the project, the more I kept thinking to myself, you know, the problem is nobody's going to take the Jewish communities of Europe as, in Western Europe, as a representative case study for Europe as a whole, because they're going to say Jews were different economically. And so mm-hmm. what initially started as an introduction, oh, well, I'll set the story straight, over time became the dissertation that turned into the book, The Myth of the Medieval Jewish Moneylender. So that's a very long answer to your question.
Yeah. That's great. So in the book, as you've just said, that you critique what you call the mythic meta-narrative of the medieval Jewish moneylender. I was wondering if you can explain for our audience what this mythic meta-narrative is. Mm-hmm. And why it's so deleterious for understanding the roles that Jews have played in political and economic life, both past and present. As mm-hmm. well, perhaps you could talk about how the narrative has changed over time.
Mm-hmm. Sure. So the narrative is one that tells a story of European economic development as something which is spurred by the Jewish population as modernizers. The way this kind of simple narrative goes is that in the early medieval period, the Jews were the traders for Western Europe until European peoples, and this is a very 19th century version right now, European peoples developed enough to take on trade for themselves. Once they had done so, they pushed Jews out of trade, and Jews turned to the new economic niche, which was opening up, that is credit, and they became the moneylenders for Europe. Money lending, as we know from our wise modern perspective, is necessary, or credit is necessary for economic development. And so the Jewish moneylenders were actually benefiting Europe. And yet at the same time, they suffered an anti-Semitic backlash for providing credit, right, or tagged as usury at the time. So they suffered a backlash precisely for doing the thing that was in Europe's best interest. So a tragic tale. So this is the standard narrative that you've had from, I would say, the late 19th century through today. We can talk maybe a little bit later about how it's grounded in older layers of history. But mm-hmm. as a mainstream academic narrative, it emerges in late 19th century Germany in particular as a philo-Semitic story. In other words, one that's sympathetic to the Jews, sympathetic to the kind of plight that they suffered, and one which is, though it's presented by members of the German Historical School of Political Economy, it's grounded in the work of Jewish historians and in the interwar period, and particularly during World War II, as the Holocaust is happening in the latter part of the war. There are a number of Jewish emigres who take up the narrative and really refashion it in relation to the Holocaust. And that narrative then has become the one that we find in history textbooks, we find in Jewish museums. It's kind of a common piece of history that a lot of people know. But you know, one thing to point out about this narrative is that it is dropped down in different places at different times. And as a historian who looks for uniqueness and contingency in historical events, when I see the same narrative being used in three different places and periods of time, I become very suspicious. So medieval England, northern France, 13th century is one locus for this narrative. Another is 15th, 16th century Italy. And the third one is early modern Germany and the court Jews. So it can be tweaked in different ways, but that's essentially the narrative. Maybe I should just point out that I call it a meta-narrative. Pretty much in the sense that the postmodern philosopher Lyotard uses it as a grand narrative, master narrative. And for me, that signals the fact that it's a kind of framework. It's the box within which we've been asking questions, but we've never questioned that box itself, that framework. And once we do so, I think that new avenues of exploration will open up.
So can you tell us about why you see this box, this meta-narrative, as so problematic and so damaging?
Right. Well, it shares a lot of assumptions with anti-Semitic stereotypes. And in fact, it's really just an inversion of those stereotypes based on a liberal economic point of view, that the development of markets, commerce, et cetera, is positive. Therefore, Jewish money lending was positive. My own research has attempted to show that this that most Jews were not money lenders, even in the very places and periods where we thought that most Jews were, and that most of the Jewish population were quite poor. And so my target audience are really Jewish studies scholars, the Jewish public, Jewish museum curators, and so on, who are, they're not anti-Semitic at all. But I think attempting to start there and change the kind of stereotypes that are still very strong and still circulate really widely today is strategically, I think, a best place to begin to revise those. And hopefully once textbooks are rewritten and so on, then it will gain more purchase.
Yeah, and you're saying that both the positive and the negative version of this story, just to clarify, end up both being equally problematic because they don't challenge the meta narrative, the meta frame or box. Is that correct?
Right. And they both assume that Jews are, in a way, non-European. They're different, they're other. That Jews perform this modernizing role in the economy, that there's something in some inherent connection, and this is framed differently by different thinkers, but an inherent connection between Jews, Judaism, and money. Let's see, what else do they share? Well, I think that's enough. Yeah.
Well, this actually dovetails nicely, or leads us nicely into the next question we had for you, which is, we're certainly interested in your project for pushing back against a problematic history of the Jewish people and this problematic figure of the Jew. But it also speaks to our interest in heterodox economics and modern monetary theory and, you know, what's also known as neo-chartalism, which understands that money is a medium that arises not from, as another great myth of modernity goes, not from private barter relations between individual people, but from a centralized governance project, whether that project is the Catholic Church in the High Middle Ages, or it's the emerging modern nation state. And it struck us that your critique of the Jewish moneylender as a kind of origin of modern European political economy really speaks to and helps flesh out the modern monetary theory critique that barter is somehow this asocial, external, interpersonal activity that somehow begins on the fringes of society and comes into the middle, rather than actually starting as a governance project. And I was wondering, how much did you think about this barter myth while you were researching and writing your book? And has your thinking changed as you've kind of, come into contact with folks like us embracing your work and beginning a dialogue?
Yeah, that's a great question. there are kind of two different ways I go with that. In attempting to figure out where this narrative had come from and what was inaccurate about that, I was led back into 19th century political economy and into this school specifically known as the German Historical School of Political Economy. And there, the way in which they describe the historical development of economy is in discrete stages. So you go from barter to money to credit would be the most simple kind of schema, but you can get more complex ones up to 7 or 8 stages, I think, among depending on which thinker you're looking at. And I became aware of the fact that the very same intellectuals that were thinking through the historical development of economy were also those that were thinking about Jews as modernizers, Jews as having like an instinctive kind of capitalist instinct. Those would be, I mean, some of the names there would be Wilhelm Rauscher, then Werner Zombart and Max Weber would be two others who kind of carry the historical school forward and at the same time are kind of bringing forward Marxism into academic discussion. And so for all these thinkers, the two really worked hand in hand. That is, the stages theory of economy, or what you refer to as the barter myth, is closely linked to this narrative about Jews as moneylenders. And the reason why is that with the stages theory, you need an agent that's going to propel movement from one stage to the next. And in this construct, Jews are defined as a non-European people. They're on the outside. They're already civilized. There's along with this is an organic folk model for how nations evolve and develop. It follows a kind of pattern of the human life cycle. And so the Jewish population is seen as older, more advanced, mature, and they then teach the Europeans like a tutor does, tutors them in trade and economy, and so on. And so if you have this stages theory, you also have to have an outside agent that's going to propel that change forward. So that's how I saw the two linked, and they became disjoined in the 20th century with kind of critiques. So there are people who've critiqued a few, who've critiqued the Jewish narrative, and then there are a whole bunch of others, medieval historians who really created the field of medieval economic history, who critiqued the stages theory. Let me just pause there. You had asked me to bring this up to MMT.
Sure. I think the connection to MMT is MMT insists that there is no outside. Money doesn't begin outside. It's always internal, and it's always internal to a centralized governance project. So it seems to us that there's a kind of homology here in critiquing the Jew as outsider who's not, and money itself as outsider as not. And it seems to me that the Jew then becomes, I mean, yes, we've long thought about the Jew as scapegoat, but the Jew becomes here a scapegoat for an emerging modern Europe's incapacity to deal with its own its own monetary technology as internal to itself.
Yes.
If that makes sense.
Yes, yes, absolutely. Yeah. So that, I guess the second part of my, the story of my kind of intellectual journey is that in my initial interest in this relationship between household and market, I hit on through a Hungarian economist, your conversation with a Hungarian economist on Karl Polanyi. And his work, not only in the Great Transformation, but particularly the work that he did later with a group of ancient historians, sociologists, anthropologists at Columbia University in the 1950s, really was an inspiration for the way in which I have approached economy. So, and what he says, and that, and I think this is, runs right along side the barter myth. And if David Graeber's work would be the one who coined barter myth, I'm not sure if that's the case. He also is influenced then by Karl Polanyi, because there's a whole anthropological tradition influenced by him. And what he says is that the economy is an instituted process. There's no such thing as a separate market. Rather, it's created and constructed by governments. And the Great Transformation that he wrote during the last years of the war is really a brilliant study that argues that even the free market per se is only possible when it's constructed by governments and when it's closely regulated by governments. So what emerges out of this kind of tradition of work around Polanyi is what's known as the substantive economics. And that is redefining economics, not as money, market, and trade, but rather as the substance that we require as human beings for continuing our lives, for improving our lives, and so on. So in that way, it's quite in line with MMT. And what I was seeking for, both in the dissertation and it remains an open question for me. I haven't, I think, solved this problem yet, but was to find a way to narrate European economic history from this kind of Polanyi-esque model. Economy is an instituted process, which gets rid of the barter myth. And maybe not surprisingly, a lot of medieval historians that have contributed to that rethinking of money and coinage. People like Mark Bloch and others.
In your book, you do spend quite a bit of time on the medieval period, and you suggest that the Jewish moneylender myth originates in the medieval period. So I wanted to ask what the main social, legal, and cultural features that you find in medieval society, and how we've repeated those structures and perhaps the meta-narrative of those structures in a way which is wrong. And to those ends, you've mm-hmm. you started to mention some historians who've dealt with the medieval question of money and anti-Semitism a little bit. In your book, you draw on Giacomo Todeschini's critical analysis of these medieval Franciscans and find the roots of modern market-based society in their thought. And I was wondering how your story about medieval times and the Jewish medieval moneylender myth develop or even complicate his narrative.
Yeah, let me respond to Todeschini first, then maybe I'll go back to those social legal features of medieval society that do initiate this association between Jews and usury. I see Todeschini's work and my own as like a pair that fits together beautifully, though I did most of my work before I encountered his, and I've not yet really integrated his thinking into mine. He goes at it from the angle of intellectual history, looking particularly at those new kinds of Christian movements, like the Franciscans in particular, that are defining the best kind of Christian life around the ideal of voluntary poverty. And it's those individuals who not only are the radical preachers and kind of movers of medieval Western Christianity at the time, but they also become the great intellectuals in the universities. So they're also the sort of thinkers that are initiating new kinds of ideas about economy. What are the limits? What's permissible? What's impermissible? And my own work goes at it from the angle of on the one hand, Jewish history and sort of traditional economic history, and at the same time from 20th century historiographic tradition and how it's been constructed. So I think our work really sits well together. What he really brings out is that one of the things that has emerged by the 15th century is a notion of the good merchant over against the bad user. And this is depicted, you know, brilliantly, of course, in Shakespeare's Merchant of Venice, where you have those two ideals pitted against each other. Well, what is it that makes one different from the other? It's not actually the economic activity that they're doing, but it's the valuation, or the assessment of the value of their activity for the community as a whole. So a merchant is seen as a good merchant because whatever he's doing economically benefits the Christian society as a whole. And the user, whether Jewish or not Jewish, is seen as bad because what they're doing, their economic activity, is harmful to the good of the community as a whole. And these labels of like merchant and user are also deeply rooted in religious notions, so that only a Christian, a true Christian, can be a good merchant. So Jews, in a way, are already they're set up to be users by virtue of being non-Christians and the major non-Christian religious minority in Europe at the time. So what we can still see these kinds of associations, like in the use of words like trust, which can have an economic meaning, but also has a kind of a moral meaning as well. And so this kind of intellectual history piece of it, I think, is really important. And what strikes me most about Todeschini's work is the way in which he's uncovering the medieval Christian and theological roots of many of our basic economic concepts. If I may, I'll go in a little bit more about usury here. One of the misconceptions is that in the medieval period, and here you're going to hear again a kind of a stages theory, this is a narrative I do not agree with, that in the earlier medieval period, it was a church-dominated society, it was an agrarian society, economy was static. In the 12th and 13th century, we see what medievalists would refer to as a commercial revolution happening, spurred by agricultural revolution, demographic growth, and so on. And the church now is put in a position where they can no longer hold the line against usury, but they have to give in to the market. So we have a model where market and religion are in conflict, in tension with each other. Religion has to give way to the progress of market society. In fact, what's happening is really different. There isn't a prohibition on usury except for clergy until we hit this high medieval commercial revolution. And it's the very same Franciscan, Dominican thinkers who hold up poverty as the ideal Christian life, who are thinking out both what is permissible economically and what is not permissible. And so they are the ones that really flesh out and create a concept of usury at the very same time that they're creating all kinds of ways to loan and make a profit on that loan that's perfectly legitimate. So they actually invent the term interest. And that has no negative moral implications to it. So there are actually two things that go hand in hand. So that usury really is, and here I know other medievalists that work on this would agree with me here, that usury is really just a label that marks out someone as undesirable, right? Usury should not be understood as lending money on profit. So I was going to go back to the first part of your question about social, legal, cultural features that lead to the development of this conception of Jews as users. So I've told some of this story in terms of the Franciscans and the kind of intellectual thought that's going into economy. And so it's not a surprise that the outsider, the Jewish who's not one of the faithful, who's not a believer, would be tagged as a user. But there's, at the same time, a kind of development of anti-Judaism, or some would even call it anti-Semitism, in this high medieval period that I think runs together and crosses over then with this economic discourse, so that Jews are seen as an internal enemy during a period of really rampant crusading, who is dangerous and who wishes to harm Christian society out of sheer malice. And one of the ways in which they could do that potentially is through their economic activity. Having said that, one of the things I try to emphasize to other medievalists is that actually the usury, there's a whole a church campaign against usury, and that campaign is actually not focused on Jews. It's focused on Christians, and only kind of later is it applied to Jews. So that even this notion of the Jewish user, though we can see that stereotype developing in the 12th and 13th century, when you have great intellectuals, I believe it's Bernard of Clairvaux, who says, you know, you Christian merchants are Judaizing because of your usury, things like that. Even in that context, the principal campaign against usury is not directed towards the Jews. And so that I think actually our perception of Jewish usury is really shaped much more by a modern context of political anti-Semitism from the late 19th century on.
And so, yeah, I mean, just to like really heighten the point that you're making there is that money is central to the construction. I mean, you know, there's a lot of inversions along the way, but of the way in which modernity thinks about Jews and how anti-Semitism has developed. And I think what you've suggested and what Todeschini has suggested as well is that the drawing of the line of what the community represents and who's allowed in it,
mm-hmm.
It, you know, a lot of that work gets done in this period, and money is central to that question, and politicizing that mm-hmm. From a historical perspective is really, really important. And so that I wanted to ask you, given that, how did the myth about the Jewish medieval moneylender, how did that change shape under modern fascisms and totalitarianisms? Specifically, how did the Nazis mobilize and reshape it?
Right. There's a really good example, if I can go from a kind of the macro down to the micro, mm-hmm. Example in the thinking about court Jews during the 1920s, 30s, and 40s. And there's a famous, rather famous novel by Fuchsvanger written about one of the most famous court Jews known as Yud Zeus. It's quite a sympathetic novel, but it spurs a lot of other accounts. So there's a first archival study done by Zelma Stern. There's a play versions, and there's a film that's made in, I think it's made in England in the late 30s. Which is a very, very, very sympathetic portrait of Yud Zeus as a man. And it's the same kind of narrative then that is taken and appropriated by the Nazis and made into one of the most viciously anti-Semitic films known as Yud Zeus. And that's one that... I don't know if it still is today, but for many, many years it was banned in post-war Germany. It's something that was thought to have been seen by millions of people, to have been shown at, like Hitler youth evenings and so on. So if you look at those two films, you can see in the second one that Zeus is demonized as... actually as a rapist who is after the beautiful German blonde. So there's a demonization and other kinds of accusations that are brought together there. I don't know if that quite answers your question.
Yeah, that's...
To me, it's a really striking example of how this kind of narrative can shift. Another example would be the fact, which is often noted, that Jews Nazi Germany were demonized both as hyper-capitalist and as rabid Marxist, right? How you can be both at once, nobody's ever figured out. The figure of the court Jew is interesting because in the 30s it really becomes a kind of locus for these struggles between anti-Semites and German Jews over the question of Jewish emancipation, Jewish inclusion in the nation. And the reason they become a kind of touchstone is that they are seen as the precursors of emancipation in the sense that they were allowed to dress without a distinctive Jewish garb, to participate in court society. These individuals became quite wealthy, and a number of them, but not all of them, would shed their religious practices and certainly their religious dress and become art patrons and collectors and so on. So really, they figure in a period when integration wasn't yet allowed as an integrated precursor for Jews as a whole. But that very same kind of image of them then becomes for Nazi thinkers a great example of how Jews can present one face to the world and yet are something else. So that kind of falseness, the fakeness that's there. So that they become then a negative locus. And for that modernizer that's lying outside. Now, I haven't done this work, but I'd speculate that perhaps maybe something worth researching, whether the Nazi ideas aren't grounded in that notion of a stages theory of economic development, in which all societies go through these stages in the same sequence, arriving at a fully developed economy at the end of that role, and that they are the Nazi thinkers, in other words, are drawing from that German historical school, which itself was quite phallocentric. They're drawing the notion of the Jews as that outside agent that is affecting the modernization. I think one of the underlying elements, whether it's philo-Semitic, anti-Semitic, is the notion that court Jews, Jewish bankers, in the medieval period, Jewish moneylenders, represent the Jewish community as a whole. They stand in for all other Jews, and therefore, one can say the Jews, quote unquote, had a powerful economic role in Europe. So that's one piece of it. And then we have to pay attention, though, also to the fact that there's a process of racialization that's going on, where Jewishness is being redefined not as a religion, but really as a racial national essence, which is alien from European peoples and alienated from European political and class structures.
So I want to give you a chance to potentially put something into relief that feels to me like at the level of the larger stakes of your project and your claims, which is we've long known that the Jew as a figure has played the role of a scapegoat, and that role, that figure and that sort of phantom, if you will, played a central role in various moments in the rise of modern anti-Semitism, and maybe we could say culminating at a moment with World War II. But how does your rethinking of the myth of the Jewish moneylender and really taking us outside of that meta-narrative frame, how does it rethink the critique of Jew as scapegoat? Like what is the, how would you put that? How would you speak back to the Jewish community, Jewish studies scholars, maybe Marxists who also will use the trope of the Jew as scapegoat? I'm curious if you have any thoughts about that.
I would start there with Hannah Arendt's Origins of Totalitarianism. And I'm not sure I can pull a quote out of my head about this, but she starts off with a critique of both the notion of a Jewish scapegoat and the notion of Jews as all powerful. And she's seeking for some way in between those two. And an article that I've been working on then goes on to unpack the way in which she appropriates and transforms also the narrative of the Jewish moneylender in order to answer that question. So my reading of her is quite critical at that point, but I think her initial starting point, which is to firmly reject both the scapegoat and the notion of Jewish power, is right on. So my own work, I think, does both also. And it leaves us, I think, in a kind of uncharted terrain in terms of thinking through how we describe a variety and the diversity of Jewish economic life. How do we narrate the Jewish history from the medieval period through the early modern ghettoization, expulsions, to then emancipation and the opening up of European life and the integration that happens later. So I think that's really an open question. It does, you know, as my lovely life companion likes to joke, that my book is writes Jews out of history. So it does, in fact, you know, my argument does argue that Jews are not the central, in terms of economic development, that the scapegoating function, right, is not at least a real part of the narrative. I mean, there are points where it can be a kind of imaginary accusation, but it's not real because most Jews weren't, in fact, moneylenders. So it leaves us at a point that's more ambiguous, ambivalent, and therefore, I think, difficult also to immediately integrate with kind of political action. I was at the Association of Jewish Studies conference in December, and one of the things that we discussed in the panel that I was on was Jews for Racial and Economic Justice, a pamphlet that they had put out that uses that narrative in order to explain kind of anti-Semitism, explain Jews to non-Jews. You know, it's it's used for good purposes, and yet I think it's something, it's dangerous because it's easy to flip it back on its head and turn that all on its head. So so I wish I had a good answer for what we could substitute, you know, as a kind of new narrative in order to answer that. It doesn't have the kind of defensive force that a concept of scapegoating does have behind it. This is part of my argument too, why this narrative becomes so important in the 20th century, and something that people hold to so strongly, is that it really provided the best support against anti-Semitic rhetoric. My own feeling is that where we are in terms of a post-Holocaust moment and the kind of absorption of the Holocaust in North America, in Europe, has put us in a different place. But since I was at the end of the book to today, right, the whole world has changed. And so there are ways in which the anti-Semitic rhetoric with new kinds of fascisms is rearing its head. And my more nuanced, careful, ambiguous history, maybe it's not, maybe simply the post-Holocaust setting that we're in isn't going to be strong enough to allow that to be sufficient.
I guess I would say, in defense of your project, what your companion says is that, you know, you've made Jews no longer, you know, the center of history. To me, the great achievement here is by you've actually integrated Jews into history. And so it's not simply that you leave us with ambiguity and a kind of leave us with an important critical ambiguity, but it's also you're telling us that there is no outside and there are no figures that are outside, and political economy is and social life and culture is complicated and contested, and that if we want to avoid fascistic tendencies or the rise of fascistic forms of governance, we have to fully reckon with our mutual interrelatedness and our social interiority.
Yeah, that's beautifully put. I would say, I have said, on an intellectual level, that the revision of our understanding of Jewish history has really important implications for our understanding of economic history more broadly, which I think you all responded to, and recognizing that my book speaks to common interests with the MMT movement.
I'm currently working on a project on the Jewish critical theorist, 20th century critical theorist, Siegfried Krakauer. And he has this figure for what he calls himself, his so-called wandering Jew. He calls himself extraterritorial. And intellectual theorists have thematized this in talking about critical theory and his ideas. But it seems to me what your work shows, and then as you bring it together, as you were suggesting, with heterodox economics, there's really this reassertion of intraterritoriality, and the ways in which they don't eliminate or annihilate difference, but the different experience of being a Jew in the 20th century or throughout modernity and earlier. And I think, as Scott was saying, and as your work has shown, it really isn't a difference that is categorical in a sense that changes the way in which we need to think about what our community is and what it represents and who deserves power and a voice in that community. And obviously we would say everyone because everyone's already inside it. So I just want, you know, mm-hmm. just to highlight, mm-hmm. I think your work really, really puts into sharp relief the sort of way forward that you were alluding to, and in integrating Jews back into history, I think having that in mind is just such a really important idea.
Yeah, thank you for that comment. That's a wonderful way to see my own thinking expanding far beyond borders that I had imagined.
So I want to shift gears a little bit and go back to some of the origins of modern monetary theory and chartalism, mm-hmm. Which was, it has a long history that takes us, you know, all around the world and into the medieval period and before. But in its sort of high modern form, it was, originated or re-originated by this figure, Georg Friedrich Knapp, who happened to not only be a late 19th, early 20th century German, but he also belonged to the German historical school, mm-hmm. That is so much responsible for the myth of the Philo-Semitic myth of the Jewish moneylender. And you may or may not have encountered or thought all that much about Knapp, but you know, his claim was that money is a creature of the state. And I think implicit in what he was saying was that there is no outside, there is no external private barter relationship that then somehow is absorbed by the center of the community. And I was wondering if you've encountered Knapp in your work and if you've given much thought about that.
I have encountered Knapp in my work as one of the representatives, as you said, of the German historical school, one of the known as the younger German historical school. And in particular, in terms of his model of the stages of economic development. And actually, after I was at the recent MMT conference, I returned home and I was reading up on neo-chartalism and discovered, right, the surprising fact that Knapp is actually also a basis for chartalism and someone that's spoken about in reference to neo-chartalism. And I was really struck by that because it seemed to me, you know, quite contradictory. And I don't have an answer for you today, but I have a hunch. I mean, and it's a kind of issue that would be a great piece of research for an article, say. And my hunch is this, that he is both. He and the way in which chartalism fits into his model, and again, I'm speaking off the cuff here, I haven't gone back to look at his stuff, but is that it fits at the end of that sequence of economic stages, so that it's a manifestation of the modern form of economy that's at the end of the teleological trajectory. So that's my guess, and if I'm right about that, then I think this kind of tension between the barter myth and chartalism, I think, raises some critical issues for neo-chartalism, for MMT more generally, and those are really around the issue of whether the critiques of MMT scholars are applicable only to nation-state models, or whether they can be extended, and how can they be extended beyond nation state? And I think that's a really important question to take up, not only because the EU still exists, but because we're at a moment in history where, yes, we still have strong nation states, but intellectually, I think the thinking is moving to transnational models, and that's where, you know, in terms of our political structures, where we're headed. What do you think?
I think those are all important and interesting tensions to think about. I will say that in my own experience, the history of charterless thinking sometimes gives up when it comes to history. They'll put charterism in the present, and then they'll it gets lost at the origin. I will say that not in MMT 101 soundbites for the public, but in the actual scholarship in a lot of the actual scholarship, mm-hmm. I'll say, there is a less positivistic and much more elastic understanding of what is meant by a state. And it's not, we don't mean a modern nation state.
Okay.
And, you know, you might have noticed that I kept using the expression centralized governance.
Okay.
Right. So, you know, that can be overlapping. It can be nested. It can be called different things. It can be organized in a number of ways. But this is sort of just to get away from the disembedded barter, the disembedded market, those sorts of imaginaries, basically.
Right. Right.
As you were talking, I was thinking, I had done a little bit of reading a while back of Sombart talking about Knapp. And maybe this will illuminate something about Knapp that's maybe only implicit, but it seems like Sombart seems to draw a distinction between commerce money and state money. And so there seems to be this sense that, I mean, I think as your intuitions suggested, that there's a contradiction happening, and it's happening simultaneously, mm-hmm. in this sense that there is both commerce or commodity money and state money, and they both come from private actors who implicitly, right, often Jews, and the state, and that they're sort of trying to straddle this on both sides in order to not allow for the incoherence to actually change the way that they're thinking, at least Sombart in this case, about the question of where the money comes from.
Yeah, that's a wonderfully illuminating comment. And it brings to my mind also a distinction that I find troubling as well. I think that kind of runs maybe alongside that one, which is the distinction between credit for consumption and credit for production. So if the one is highly valued, the second is highly valued, and the first is not, which ignores, to get back to Karl Polanyi, right, really the basic definition of economy, right, which really hinges on consumption, right? We're not economic actors in order to make profits, but in order to live,
right, and that consumption is inextricable from the production and the allocation of credit for such production.
Exactly.
Well, I'm curious, maybe for a final question, if we could come back to the present moment. I mean, I don't think anybody here is an expert, political scientist or political theorist who has, you know, mapped all of what's going on right now across the globe. But as you noted, we're at a moment of where we're seeing the rise of various kinds of neo-fascisms. And you mentioned that those neo-fascisms. Some of them are include and are turning upon the figure of the the negative figure of the Jew. And I'm curious if we could just zoom in a bit. And do you have any examples of that? And then also, I'm curious if you've noticed. Are there other examples of rising neo-fascisms that don't call upon the figure of the Jew? And if they don't, how are they working? And are they maybe working in the same kind of meta narrative and frame, but without naming the Jew specifically? I'm just kind of curious if you've been thinking about the present geopolitical context.
Right. I have. I would say that a number of the events, I think, in Hungary are particularly disturbing, and that the kind of neo-fascism there has gone much further than we've seen in other areas. I'm having trouble thinking of a specific instance right now that would be a good example of the anti-Semitism there. But I'll turn to the other sort of side of that question. Do I see it appearing in other ways, other places? Yes. I think the figure of the Muslim and the Muslim immigrant is really a much greater target than Jews in these new movements. And whether it's a really interesting question for me, whether there are patterns or tropes, meta-narratives that have moved from anti-Semitism to this anti-immigrant language or anti-Islamic language. And yes, in certain ways, but I don't think it's the economic ones there. I would say the immigrant is posed as an internal danger, to society in the same way that the medieval Jew was, that the immigrant is seen as one that's taking something that belongs to the citizens of that nation, that's somehow a threat, and that's heightened through the association between the association that's made unjustly between Islam and terrorism. So there's similarities, I guess, structurally that I see there. And I see very much the immigrant populations, not only the Muslim population, but immigrant populations in the U.S. and Europe, in a very similar situation to the Jewish population previously in the history. That is marked out as the outsider, the unwanted outsider, and so on.
Well, Julie Mell, thank you so much for coming on Money on the Left.
Thank you all so much. Enjoy the conversation.
Thanks.
Now you're-